And we turn to God's Word this morning, to the book of John in chapter 18. Did you catch in the news this morning, if you happen to watch that the governor's mansion in Austin burned last night? It was under renovation. The governor and his wife were not living in it at the time, and at least the vast majority of the valuable antiques and paintings and so forth were not in there, but they did have a fire, and it's a near total loss, if not a total loss. 152 years old. It just reminds us that nothing lasts forever, no matter how valuable and cherished it might be. But then when we say nothing lasts forever, that's not entirely true, is it? Because God's Word endures forever. And part of what has endured for now 2,000 years from God's Word are the stories about Jesus. It's how we know about Him. It's what we know about Him. And as we've been reading some passages in John over the last month or so, we've been stopping at those passages in particular where we hear Jesus ask someone a question. When John wrote this down 1900-something years ago, it seems he was struck by the fact that Jesus always asked questions that question would put, so to speak, a finger on an important subject. You sometimes have gone to a doctor, or some of us use a chiropractor if your back is out or something's not quite right. And it seems like the really good chiropractors are the ones who know right where to put the finger or the hand and push. It's the sore spot. It's the spot that needs to be taken care of. And that's sort of the way it was with the questions that Jesus asked of others. Last week, when he washed his disciples' feet, it's the night before he's going to die. And yet, as he's gathered with them to celebrate the Passover feast, one of the things that he does is strips himself down until he just is dressed like a servant, a slave, and goes around and washes each one of their feet because none of them were humble enough and didn't have enough of a servant spirit among themselves to do that for each other. So he did it for them, even though he was the greatest of them. And after he'd finished that, he asked them the question, "Do you understand what I've done for you?" You see, there was that question that really brought it down to the heart of what it was all about. And over again, we've seen him doing that. Today is the same way. That supper is over. They've left that upper room. The city all around them, the city of Jerusalem, is celebrating the Passover feast. And by this time, everyone has finished their Passover meal. And some are settling down for sleep, and others are staying up, reminding themselves that so many hundreds of years before, that God, that night, hundreds of years before, had sent the angel of death through Egypt. And while protecting the Jewish people because they had obeyed God, that angel of death passed over them, and so the name Passover, but had killed the firstborn in the household of every family in Egypt. And before dawn the next morning, the Pharaoh of Egypt is having someone pound on the door of Moses' house saying, "Get out of here. Leave us. Egypt cannot endure you any longer." And so they went out, a free people. And that's what Passover was celebrating. But here Jesus is celebrating that Passover with his disciples, and then they go out and they cross out of the city across the Kidron Valley and the Kidron Brook, which we'll have more to say about in a few minutes, and went up onto the side of the Mount of Olives, this small mountain that was just to the east of Jerusalem itself. And while the city itself is just filled overflowing with pilgrims and travelers who have come in for this great celebration, there is this one place there on the Mount of Olives where Jesus can find some solitude and some peace. And it's in this garden, as it's called. Garden, not in the way we think of gardens today with vegetables and things like that, but rather a grove. A grove of olive trees, in the middle of which is an olive press, where they would take the olives from the trees and press the olives to get the precious olive oil. And it wasn't just any olive oil. It was a special olive oil that was used in the sacrifices and in filling the lamps in the temple. And yet here he is with permission to be in that special grove there on the Mount of Olives that night. And it's not the first night he's been there. The scriptures tell us that he often retreated to that spot when he was in Jerusalem. So apparently he had some very special friend of great influence who could give him that access and that permission. That person remains unnamed in the scriptures. And yet they rendered a great service to the Lord and to his disciples during that time to give them access to such a place. And that's where we're at in this story at this moment. And so we start reading John chapter 18. When he had finished praying, and chapter 17 is the prayer that Jesus prayed while they were there in that garden, in that grove. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples. I'm sorry, it was a prayer before they went, obviously. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they replied, "Jesus of Nazareth." So Jesus said, "I am he." And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." "I told you that I am he," Jesus answered. "If you're looking for me, then let these men go." And this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled, that "I have not lost one of those you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me?" Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officers arrested Jesus, and they bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. So here's Jesus there on the side of the Mount of Olives. It's late into the night by this time. If we read the other accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we have to conclude it has to be 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning by this time. Not only has he and his disciples celebrated the Passover feast in Jerusalem itself and then left that place after Jesus had this prayer that's recorded in chapter 17 and come across and into the garden, but then over the next 3 hours after they first arrived, the other accounts tell us Jesus on 3 occasions leaves his disciples in one place and goes elsewhere in the grove and prays fervently to God. And the substance of that prayer he prays all 3 times is, "Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. But not my will, yours be done." The scriptures even tell us that as he prayed, his perspiration, his sweat, were just like large drops of blood dropping from his face as he prayed, how intense he was in his prayer. And it's at the end of those some 3 hours of praying that he comes back to his disciples, and almost at that same moment, suddenly here comes this large crowd in the middle of the night with torches and lanterns and weapons to arrest him. Let's think about some things that are going on here. First of all, we need to realize that there's a plot afoot. I learned that word from Sherlock Holmes. Never used it before until my wife started watching him on television in some of those series. But anyway, there's a plot afoot. Several years ago, someone wrote a book which was very disrespectful of both history and of the scriptures called The Passover Plot, in which they put forth this outrageous and totally unsubstantiated idea that Jesus actually had planned some way to make it appear like he was going to be killed, but he wasn't going to. The truth is, there was a real Passover plot. And this real Passover plot was a plot that had been put together by the leading Jewish officials in Jerusalem to get rid of Jesus. And in order for that plot to come about, it ended up needing one of Jesus' own disciples named Judas to turn traitor and be willing to give them access to Jesus at a time when they could arrest him and take him into custody without there being a lot of other people around who might be supporters of Jesus and so prevent that. That was the real Passover plot. And now it's coming to fruition here. Originally, they didn't want to arrest Jesus during the Passover time because so many people were in the city and so many of the people had come from up in Galilee where Jesus was from. And so many up there were supporters of Jesus. The Jewish leaders were afraid there would be public riots and so forth if the people knew Jesus had been arrested. But it just seemed like that the opportunity was too great and they took advantage of the opportunity they had at this moment to arrest him in spite of their earlier plan not to at this moment. Jesus asks the soldiers when they arrive and the officials, he says, "Who is it you want?" You know, in some ways that question was a part of Jesus' entire ministry. Because most of the common people wanted Jesus to be the Messiah. They wanted him to be the one in the Old Testament that was going to be a descendant of David, who was going to be a deliverer. They had mistakenly thought that when this promised one from the Old Testament came, that he would be a military genius, that he would be a general in effect, that he would raise up an army and he would drive out the Romans and he would set their nation free. And they would be an independent nation once again. That's what they wanted Jesus to be. There were among the people some who were deeply spiritual and who hoped that Jesus was the one from the Old Testament who would set the people free from their sins, who would lead the people back to God again, who read those Old Testament prophecies and realized that the promise was that he would be prophet, priest and king, that he would be a spokesman for God like Moses was, that he would be a priest for God like the high priest always was supposed to be, and that he would be the king, he would be God's spiritual leader. And they, like Nicodemus back in John chapter 3, fervently hoped Jesus was that person. Well, what did the Jewish leaders want Jesus to be? Obviously, they're the ones who are instituting this arrest that's about to take place here. What did they want Jesus to be? Honestly, they wanted Jesus to be invisible. They didn't want any trouble out of him. They didn't want him to do anything that upset anything that they were in charge of. From their point of view, if Jesus spoke publicly against them, if he taught anything that disagreed with what they taught, if he drew around him any group of people who seemed to be following him, he was a troublemaker as far as they were concerned. And so they wanted him to be, for all intents and purposes, a nobody. They didn't want the Messiah. They didn't want the Deliverer. They didn't want the one from the Old Testament prophecies to come. And as far as the Romans were concerned, and there were Romans here in the garden that night, all they wanted is whatever was best for Rome. As far as they were concerned, anything that caused an uproar, anything that caused a riot, anything that would cause trouble, needed to be taken care of as quickly as possible. So we have all these different people who had all sorts of different expectations about what they wanted Jesus to be. But of course, that's not really the question Jesus is asking. When he says, "Who do you want?" he simply stepped forward in front of his disciples as this crowd of people come up and says, "Who are you looking for?" But when we look at the way things are going here, we can see that they were fearful of a lot of things. First of all, we notice how many people came out that night. John speaks at a time when he writes this originally, when people still knew the Greek language and they still lived in the Roman Empire, and so they recognized the words he uses here Today, we're not so fortunate. We have to rely on dictionaries and historians and so forth to explain some of this to us. But it says there in verse 3, "So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and Pharisees." First of all, the officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, these were the temple police. The Jewish high priest maintained a small peacekeeping force, a police force, just for keeping the peace in the temple. Here they are. We've heard about them already in the book of John. You might remember once earlier they had actually sent some of these men to arrest Jesus. And when they got on the edge of the crowd where Jesus was teaching there in the temple, they heard him teaching, and eventually they go back to the chief priest. And when they get back to them, the priest says, "Where's Jesus? You were supposed to arrest him." And they said, "We never have heard anyone teach like this man is teaching." That's the same group of police, we would call them, the peacekeepers of the temple. They would be Jewish. But it says besides those, there's a detachment of soldiers. There's two things we need to know about this detachment of soldiers. First of all, the nation of Judah had no army. So for there to be soldiers, they cannot be Jewish. They have to be Roman. During Passover feast and Pentecost and the Feast of Tabernacles and the Day of Atonement and so forth, the three great Jewish feasts every year, the Romans always brought additional troops into the city to help maintain the peace. They would be stationed at the Antonia Fortress, located right next to the temple. They would be under the direct command of the governor, Pontius Pilate. He would also come in from Caesarea. He hated to live in Jerusalem, so he lived up in Caesarea. But during these great times of trouble, or potential trouble, he would always come and had a residence in the Antonia Fortress. So first of all, for them to be soldiers, they have to be Roman. For the Jews had no soldiers. They were not allowed to have any soldiers. Secondly, the word detachment that the NIV translates here is actually the Greek word spira. And that word doesn't mean a thing to me, but when I look it up in the dictionaries of the Greek language, and particularly when it has to do with Roman armies and so forth, a spira, in its most proper sense, meant one-tenth of a Roman legion. That was the way the word was commonly used. Now, a Roman legion was comprised in different times in Roman history of between 4,500 and 6,000 men. And so if this word is being used by John in its proper sense, he's saying that somewhere between 450 and 600 soldiers have been detached, along with the police from the temple to arrest Jesus. What are they expecting? Why in the middle of the night, to arrest one Jewish carpenter, do they need to send out more than 600 soldiers, fully armed? The Bible scholar William Barclay says that typically a spira would be made up of one-third cavalry and two-thirds foot soldiers, which would even mean mounted soldiers for part of them. What are they expecting? Trouble. They're making an overwhelming show of force in the middle of the night to arrest one man who at the most has 11 other men with him. The 12th man is over on the other side, isn't he? He's actually leading these people to Jesus. Now some have said, well, maybe they're not using the word detachment in that sense. So maybe it's not 600. Maybe it's not 450. But scholars still struggle to find any place where this particular Greek word ever meant less than 200. They have found, I think, one or two instances in Greek literature, or literature of that time that was in the Greek language, where it would be referred to a very small group of men of about 200. But even so, why so many? Obviously, they were afraid something was going to happen. And so I got to thinking about what did they fear. First of all, I think they feared a riot. Even though it turns out Jesus is only there with the 11 disciples, they might not have known for sure ahead of time that would be the case. Secondly, Judas had still been with Jesus earlier that night when Peter had basically asked Jesus, "Should we take swords with us?" You remember that discussion? And back in Luke chapter 23, I think it is. Jesus had, speaking rhetorically, had said, the time is now when anyone who has a sword needs to take it with them. I say he's speaking rhetorically because what he was really saying is, you need to be prepared for what's about to happen. And yet, when Peter said, Lord, we've got two swords here with us, Jesus says, that's enough. For he didn't really intend for them to have to use swords at all. I'm not sure, but what Judas might have been afraid, they were heavily armed. And so they're fearful for that. It also seems they were afraid that Jesus might be hard to identify. That's why the arrangement had been made ahead of time that Judas be with them and that Judas be the one who walks up to the real Jesus, the one they want to arrest, and kiss him. That would be the sign, wasn't it? That's how they'd know who here in the darkness with all these torches, a full moon, by the way, Passover was always a full moon, so there's plenty of light even without the torches. But with all the torches and so forth, with a detachment of several hundred soldiers and police officers from the temple who probably did not know what Jesus looked like exactly, it was important for someone to be there who knew exactly who he was. And so Judas, the betrayer, steps forward, and he's the one who's going to kiss Jesus. And they even call him by name to identify which one was the one. Clearly, they thought there might have been a possibility that Jesus might have tried to slip away or that one of the other disciples might have put himself forward and said, I'm him instead of Jesus and so forth. But the most interesting thing about all of it for me is not just how many came and how heavily armed they were, and that they wanted someone there who was an eyewitness who could actually point Jesus specifically out to them. But what happens when Jesus steps forward and says, I am him? He says, who do you want? Who is it that you're seeking? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And he steps forward and says, I am him. Did you see what happens next? They step backwards and even some of them are falling down. Why? Are they just clumsy? I don't think so. I think they're afraid. Again, realize the vast majority of those there to arrest him that night, if they've ever seen Jesus at all, it would only have been from a distance and have very little knowledge of him personally. But what have they heard about him? Feeding 5,000 people? Raising the dead? Making lame people walk, blind people see, deaf people hear? Making people grow limbs that they didn't have. Everything they've heard about Jesus says this man is capable and regularly does miraculous things. And so when he steps forward and says, I am him, they don't want to be too close in case he unleashes some lightning bolt from heaven or something. But there's even something else here. John is kind of unique among the four gospel writers as he tells the story of Jesus by telling us several different times during his life, Jesus would say something rather unusual. He would say that I am. In the English, it says, I am he. In the Greek, it doesn't have the he there. I don't know if you realize that or not. Much earlier in John chapter 8, when Jesus was having an argument with the Jewish officials, Jesus told them that Abraham looked forward to seeing Jesus come. And in fact, that he and Moses both had seen Jesus coming and had rejoiced in it. And this sort of confused the officials. They said, how can these fellows who lived, you know, one of them 1,400 years ago and another one 1,800 or 1,900 years before their time, how could these men have seen your coming? And Jesus' answer to them was that before they were even born, I am. That's a very strange statement for us. But it wasn't strange for the Jewish people because in their language, now we're moving from the Greek language back into the Hebrew language. In their language, the name of God was Yahweh. We say Jehovah. But their name for him was Yahweh. But Yahweh means I am. That's the translation of the word. It's the word that God gave Moses at the burning bush all those centuries before. When Moses says, well, if you're going to send me back to Egypt, who do I tell them sends me? And God spoke to him there at the burning bush and said, tell them that the I am is sending you. And John points out to us through his gospel that several different times Jesus told the people that I am the I am. And that meant a great deal to the Jews. It meant to the Jews that Jesus was claiming to be Yahweh, God. Now, obviously, the Jewish leaders disagreed with that. That's part of the reason they wanted to arrest him. They considered that sacrilege, blasphemy, a mockery. Of course, the other possibility is it could have actually been true. You know, you don't have two choices when someone claims to be God. Either he is or he isn't. They believed he wasn't. He said he was. Well, this night, when they come to arrest him and they said, who do you want? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth, he says, I am. Now, perhaps at least the Jewish ones among those who have come to arrest him know he's just making the claim again to be God. And just in case, they don't want to be too close. That's why they're falling backwards, to get out of the way. And so he asked them a second time, who is it you want? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And once again, Jesus says, I am. So, not only did people have all sorts of different expectations about who they wanted Jesus to be, but they had all sorts of different expectations that night. I even think about the disciples that night. What's going through their minds? Up until this moment in the garden, they had to be on an emotional and spiritual high. For they think, and maybe Judas even had thought before he left Jesus that night, that Jesus is in town this week. It's not weekend yet, this week, in order to finally declare himself the king they've all been waiting for. To exert his power and authority and control and become that great general and great king that they were looking for. And certainly the support is there among the common people. Jerusalem is filled with tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who were supporters of Jesus. And so they would certainly think this would be the great time, and they seem to be expecting that, even though Jesus keeps telling them that exactly the opposite is going to happen. And so now, suddenly, in just a few moments, their whole world is falling apart. The soldiers have come out to arrest Jesus. Jesus isn't putting up any resistance. One of their dear friends is over there with the other guys. Judas, the one none of them knew was a traitor, has now come and kissed Jesus and identified him to the soldiers so they can arrest him. Jesus has this perfect moment in which he could use his miraculous power to just drive them all back or show that he was God, and he doesn't do it. Peter even pulls out the sword he has, and he's no soldier, he's a fisherman. So, you know, he's going to use a sword more like a fisherman would, not like a soldier. But he does it, and it's such a surprise to everyone that he manages to take one swing and cut off some poor man's ear. And Jesus immediately commands him to put it away and get back and steps forward and puts the man's ear back on his head and heals him instantly. That was the only miracle that took place that night. By doing that, Jesus instantly stops a massacre. If he hadn't done what he did at that moment, these 11 men with him were dead men. Here's the troops, 200 to 600 or more, fully armed, ready for any kind of resistance. And if he hadn't done what he had done, and by the sheer force of his personality and character, stops it all. A lot more we could say about what was going on that night. You know, when they came out of that upper room and came out of Jerusalem, out the city gates, came, as it says here, even in our record, they crossed the Kidron Valley. The Kidron Valley was this valley on the east side of the city that had a small stream running through it. It ran most all year. There were a few times during the year it would be too dry to run, but this wasn't one of them. And a very interesting thing happens on the day of Passover as they're slaughtering the lambs up in the temple. The blood from these tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of lambs that are being slain, as they're being killed, part of their blood is being caught and splashed on the sides of the altar up there. But there's also a groove that has been cut in the pavement of the temple. And it catches the blood as it drains from these animals. And it carries that blood out to the brook, Kidron. And literally, the records of that time says, this groove ran full of blood and the Kidron brook ran with blood. all that day and all that night from all this blood from the animals that have been slaughtered. And so how typical, how symbolic it was for Jesus to walk across on the little bridge probably that crossed over the Kidron Brook and to look down and see the blood from all these animals that have been slain and to know that the next day it will be His blood running. But His blood will do what that blood could never do. And then to end up in the garden of Gethsemane, the garden of the olive press, where the oil for the lighting of the lamps in the temple was always pressed out, and to know that He was the real light of the world. In Jesus this night, we see His courage. We see His commitment to what He's there for. We see His authority, as just by the sheer power of His own presence, He is in charge of this situation. They've come to arrest Him, but He's the one who's in control of the situation. And we see that He makes the choice to do God's will that night and be arrested and go through a trial and eventually be crucified rather than do what others wanted Him to do. And even in the last moments before He's arrested, we see Him protecting His own disciples by even saying, if you're looking for Me, then let these men go. And even after Peter does that very rash thing he does, still Jesus standing between His own disciples and the soldiers to make sure that they keep their focus on Him and arresting Him and not on these other men. It's all because Jesus was here on a mission. And He was going to see that that mission was accomplished.